Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, I'm Alex Merrill. Welcome to The Inspirati. I've enlisted a roster of ultra-talented international creators and curators to join me on this podcast to talk about how they've charted their individual paths, overcome challenges, and found their true artistic selves. From candid conversations with eminent makers to showcasing exciting up-and-comers across the industries of art, music, fashion, entertainment, literature, and design, we get to illuminate our perspectives, learning from these unique stars within the constellation of global creativity. The Inspirati was created for those seeking inspiration and those seeking to inspire. Thanks for listening. With a pair of boxing gloves slung over one shoulder and a head filled with East London street smarts, Zoe Buckman has arrived over the past few years as a bold face of the feminist arts movement. Her multidisciplinary work frequently speaks to universal female experiences, be it the inclusion of embroidered words on the subject of domestic violence, titling a recent show Heavy Rag, or her 43-foot sculpture Champ, a glowing neon outline of a uterus outfitted with boxing gloves, which was installed above the iconic and recently shuttered Standard Hotel, RIP, on the Sunset Strip in Hollywood. But in spite of the weighty nature of Zoe's subject matter, the art doesn't shout. It draws you in with its beauty, inviting you to the table of a nuanced conversation about the influences of patriarchy on both women and men. It wants you to feel seen. It thanks you for coming. I first met Zoe in a sweaty cycling class in New York. She's one of those rare individuals who somehow actually makes it look cool to dance on a stationary bike. And then I started seeing her at the Max Mara art parties I would DJ, always dressed beautifully. And I began to admire this woman for embodying the duality that also makes her work so striking. The balance of hard and soft, the ability to crack a joke in a serious conversation, and the desire to find and celebrate joy and freedom within hardship. We chatted about the diversity and the shades of meaning to be found in a John Keats poem or a Tupac lyric, why you can't talk about feminism without acknowledging girl-on-girl crime, and how it feels to break free from using trauma as a muse. I hope you enjoy the following hour within the illuminating perspective of the incomparable Zoe Buckman. You were my number one girl crush in Marvin's Soul Cycle class, and he just plays such good music, and you were always like there with such good vibes and rocking out on a bike and like such a babe. So you definitely made an impact. I know it's like trivial with everything that else that's going on in the world, but I really miss that.
No, I miss it so much. And I miss it so much. I've been to maybe two or three of the outdoor ones that they're doing, yeah. And it's just like, I'm not going to get freezing in your sweat. Freezes the minute you start. Just not the same.
No, and just like being in a dark room with like super amazing music and sweating together and moving as a pack. It's like one of those things that I always feel like such an idiot talking about, but it is tribal and communal, and there's something
Absolutely.
Really great about that energy that I miss.
Yeah, I agree. It's a weird thing because it's almost like in New York, particularly in the art world, like it's considered uncool to talk about stuff like that if you're a woman, you know?
Right.
But I found those classes to be really like instrumental for my mental health at certain times. And you know what else? I've had amazing ideas.
I always got ideas on that bike.
Yes.
Always.
Like you're like voguing out and it's dark and then you're suddenly like, I know how I want to do that sculpture now. And yep. It's like, I don't get that in yoga. I don't get that boxing.
I think it might be because you're so maxed out that your brain, it's almost meditative because your brain kind of goes blank and then it allows for these ideas to come in. I remember I would come home and like write all of this like new creative stuff that I come up with on that bike.
Yeah.
Crazy. How's everything been this past year for you in Brooklyn? And
I mean,
cheers on the new president, by the way.
It's good. It's good. It's definitely a sigh of relief.
Yeah.
I feel like there are some moments where I want to tear my hair out. And I'm like, I just miss like a sweaty Soul Cycle class. I miss going to the theater. I miss being like entertained and delighted by live things happening in front of me. And like, I miss being in a sweaty dance floor and all of this stuff. And I can't take it anymore. And then there are other times where I'm just so amazed at both mine and everyone around me's ability to kind of like find their way through this. And there is a lot about this time that I think I will actually miss when life returns.
I keep saying that. I keep thinking we will live to miss these days. And even though we don't have it all right now in the way we feel like we did at some other point in time when we also were complaining about something. There are lessons here and there's growth that's happening here. I'm watching it in so many of my friendships, especially with creatives who, especially people who aren't clinging to the old world.
Right.
Who are kind of like, okay, what do I do with this time? How is this special and magic in its own way?
Yeah, absolutely.
How's your daughter doing with all of the changes?
She's good. Yeah, she's good. She's back in school now, so that's been huge because she's an only child, and so the homeschooling was rough for her because, you know, at the beginning when she didn't see any other kids, that was really challenging. So comparative to that, she's having a blast. They wear masks all day, and then like maybe she'll be in school for 2 weeks and then everyone has to go home for 2 weeks because there'll be a little case happened or something, you know.
Yeah.
But she's handling it well, thank God.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
That's good. It's good. She's a little trooper.
Yeah.
Well, you are not only an incredible mom, but I know that you were raised by an incredible mom. Can you tell me a bit about her and the experience of growing up?
Yeah, absolutely. So I grew up in East London, in Hackney, in a very economically poor neighborhood, but a neighborhood that was so rich in other ways. And my mum, she was an acting coach at RADA, the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, and she was a writer. And so my household was full of like these young RADA students who would come home with my mom and she would continue giving them lessons in the living room, or they would come over on the weekend and work on like auditions with her and whatnot. And she would often take me to accompany her to rehearsals. And so from a very young age, I was exposed to theater and literature and the arts, which was, I think, very impactful for my own artistic practice and my artistic expression. She was also an activist and a feminist socialist and very warm and charismatic and rude as well. Like my mother had the potty mouth to end all potty mouth, and like a real appreciation of swear words as well. Like they were, if you had to swear, you had to swear really fucking beautifully. So yeah, I think I would like to say that I had an amazing upbringing, and in most part because of her. But you know, I think the flip side to that is that I did grow up in a neighborhood in which there was a lot of toxic masculinity. And there was even within my home that as well. I have three brothers and a dad. So it was a lot of testosterone flying about the place, a lot of aggression, which made me and my mum very close and tight knit. And she was the kind of, I don't know, she was that sort of empathetic yoke of the family. But then I would go outside of the home and it was just quite rough. And I think being a young girl and then a young woman, it was a culture that just completely accepted sexual violence.
Yeah.
And so even like, you know, I've talked to girlfriends now as we're adults, and obviously since Me Too and Time's Up, there's been more of a kind of uncovering, and people have been examining things that they went through. And I'm like, yo, do you remember that game Feel Ups? And they're like, yeah, fucking Feel Ups. And it was just this thing where like the guys would like rush you and touch you, and then you would just like curl up into a ball or whatever it was and just wait for it to be over, and then they would all disperse and run off someplace else, and like no, none of the teachers did anything about it ever.
At school,
Feel Ups. And then there was Kiss Chase as well, where you had to run and find some place to hide because the boys were going to come and try and kiss you. And like, it starts off as a small thing, but yeah, it just also implants this culture where it's like, you're not safe. What you have, who you are, is covetable. Like, you're an object that's desirable just because you're in a female body, and guys are going to come for you.
Almost like a prey animal.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. So then in a way, then when I had experiences as I got older, I was like, oh, this is familiar to me. Why is this familiar? Why is this feeling of like being chased? So, and when I say chased, I don't mean like, chastity.
Right. No, I got that.
Right. Why is the feeling of being chased so terribly familiar?
I'm like, you just went to like a whole different part of the UK with that comment.
But is she chased?
Is she chased, m'lady?
But yeah, I guess I've realized as I've gotten older that some things are nostalgic or familiar, and that is because of that very specific culture that I grew up in where it was just acceptable.
Well, and then trying to attribute right and wrong as an adult to things that you might even feel comfortable in,
right,
because of your prior experience. That's got to be an interesting psychological examination.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then also how that then affects what we're attracted to and then what we're drawn to. You know, I'll just speak for myself, but like I got really into boxing, and I look at that and it was so incredible and important for me and instrumental to my art practice and what I was going through at the time. But I think that something definitely happened for me when I walked into the boxing gym the first time, which was underground, like a real boxing gym. It was a Puerto Rican place in downtown New York. And when I walked in, I was like, oh, wow, hang on a minute. Like, this feels like home in a weird way.
Like, almost like you can rewrite some history there a bit, maybe.
Yes, exactly. Have a corrective experience, as they call it.
As they call it at the Puerto Rican boxing gym.
They call it.
So they're like, you're here for a corrective experience.
Oh, we know. We get girls like you here for a corrective experience quite a lot.
I bet. What are your early memories of creating? What was the environment? How were you nurtured to create when you were young?
Yeah, we would devise these plays, me and my brothers, and then perform them to my parents. And I was always more excited about setting out the snacks for the interval and like making the program and the tickets and like that. I really hated the acting part.
Yeah.
I think I knew even then that I was not a good actor. But I really enjoyed the bits around that. Yeah. And then, of course, like drawing and painting and you know, I remember finger painting in the garden and doing things just from a very intuitive place that, you know, I guess I kind of missed. But I think the time when I really started to think about what I was creating and like expressing how I felt or how I, you know, what I was grappling with was when I was doing photography A-level.
Okay.
So in a way, that was kind of my first I think, visual art medium was photography.
What age is A-level?
So A-level, you are 18, 19.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that was your first
medium.
Before
you go off to university. Yeah, exactly.
Got it. Okay, cool. And then you went to art school in New York or in London?
Yeah, here in New York.
Okay.
Yeah, and it was also a lens-based art school.
Okay.
It's called ICP, the International Center of Photography.
Yeah.
And so I started out, in photo.
And what themes were you exploring initially?
Oh, my God. Well, I think that my end-of-year project was awful. Like now, I'm mortified that I was making this work, and I've since destroyed it. But at the time, it's gone.
Archives have been tampered with.
Oh, yeah, they have. At the time, I thought it was brilliant. Bless.
Right.
So anyway, I did. My project was called Loos, as in toilets.
Okay.
And I was exploring how, informed by my experiences cocktail waitressing in London, which I did for 5 years, I was exploring how the space of the girls' powder room or the locker room in public spaces exists as this little unique world in which strangers, women, come together, and there's this kind of sisterhood, and they share stories or, you know, lend each other makeup or what have you. It was quite cool. So I was staging these images in different public restrooms in New York. I would get friends and actors and models and whatnot, and I would create these scenes, and then I would etch onto the glass of the photo frame snippets of real conversations that I remember overhearing when I was waitressing. Like, by the way, I used to just like hide in the toilets quite often. Like, I would go and take a break. This was pre-smoking ban, so I would sit and have a cigarette and just hear things and just think, oh my God, this is ridiculous and outrageous and hilarious.
But you were writing them down?
Yeah, I was writing them down.
Did you know why?
Mm-mm, no.
Just like a curiosity that you weren't planning on using necessarily.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So I guess, back in school, I was, you know, obviously exploring the female experience, but I think in quite a basic way, which is fair enough. You know, I was 20, 21 or 22 or something.
We all start somewhere.
Exactly.
Well, and if you were, you know, it's interesting that you were kind of exploring the female experience, but also etching, that's more of a tactile, it's not just flat photography. So you were already starting to work with medium at the beginning.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that I always felt that photography was not the right discipline for me. And I think a lot of that was to do with, you can't really touch it in a way, you know, it exists on a negative or on a digital file, which is then spat out through a printer someplace else. And then usually it's put behind glass and put on a wall. And I
there's
like
a major separation.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. And I'm much more into objects and having my hands on the object. So I think you're right that I was already, even back then, starting to work with text and the written word, but also how to make something become more of a three-dimensional sculptural object.
Yeah, absolutely. Your work now covers a lot of parts of the female experience that up until more recently haven't really had their place within public discourse, from abortion rights to domestic violence to the full depth of motherhood. What does that exploration feel like as you're sort of birthing piece after piece? Does it feel heavy? Does it feel freeing? Is it a combination of all those emotions?
I think that until recently, I've found the experience of making my work really difficult.
Yeah.
And people say, oh, this must be really cathartic for you. And it isn't, it isn't. Like, I think that standing in the gallery, once you've completed the body of work and you're pleased with it, at least to whatever degree your perfectionism will allow you to be pleased with it.
Before you're torching it later.
Exactly. there is a sense of catharsis then, like, oh, I've birthed this, like I've processed it through my work. But making the actual work and living with it, because my studio is actually my living room, right? Like I work from home. And so the experience of making work about something that I've personally gone through that was difficult for me or even traumatic mm-hmm. for me, and I'm then, you know, bringing other women and their experiences into it, and their experiences are difficult too. You know, I might be working with a wedding dress from someone's divorce, right? Yeah. Or a piece of antique lingerie that's like torn or has blood stains on it or something. Mm-hmm. And so I've felt for a long time that I'm kind of surrounded by, I guess, complex and difficult things. And so the experience of going to work in the morning, like going into my studio, is not often joyful.
And it's in your home, so it's not like there's a real clean distinction between switching that part of your brain off.
Exactly. Yeah. And I do think that is something that I would like to change going forward. However, I do think that for the first time, maybe ever, or maybe for the first time in a long time, the work that I've been making more recently, I'm arriving at a place where I'm expressing more joy through the work. And I think that that had a lot to do with the pandemic, honestly. Mm-hmm. Well, I guess just to backtrack, I should just explain that my 2020 actually started off with a pilgrimage to India.
I went to India too.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, I was there for New Year's Eve 2020.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Wow.
And it was one of those things where I was like, it's the beginning of a new decade. And I got this amazing invite to go to Jaipur and spend it like at the city palace in Jaipur. And I was so excited. My grandfather was born there.
Oh, wow.
And I've always really been interested in going. But yeah, I was watching you on Instagram and I was like, India 2020.
She's down the road. Yeah, we were there at the same time. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I had this incredible experience. I've been a few times, but I'd never taken my daughter Cleo, and she's been begging me for years. And then we took with us some of my mum's ashes. And so we had this it was such a healing experience to go back to India, to, you know, release her ashes into the Himalayan Ganges. Mm. I got into that water. It was fucking freezing. Like, I think I might have died and been reborn in that instant. Yeah. Like, it was no joke. but then, you know, also because I was with a group and I was on a pilgrimage, there was a lot of praying and exaltation, and I was doing stuff with Kundalini, which is a lot to do with this snake energy, right? And seeing these incredible temples and deities, and like I was going deeper into my practice of deity worship, mainly through Radha. So anyway, I guess all that to say, my 2020 started off like so rich and so restorative, and put me in this place where I was kind of ready to invite in joy and love into the experiences that I had gone through for the previous 3 years, including the death of my mother, the ending of my marriage, and then a relationship that was very unsafe for me following my divorce. And so then the pandemic hit, right? Yeah. And it was lockdown and I'm forced indoors. And
you're like, this was supposed to be the upbeat year.
I know, but hang on, guys, I'm ready to rave and like smile and dance and whatnot. And I very quickly miss being with my girlfriends and found myself looking at pictures of us like dancing and sweaty at, you know, this person's birthday or this person's wedding. And then also looking at my pictures of India where I was in deep prayer. And so, very long story short, during lockdown, it gave me an opportunity to connect in an even deeper and robust way with this kind of inner force that I have, that I think we all have, which is completely unaffected by external forces. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, if I gave her a name, I gave her a personality and a name, and she's called Nomi, and she's a lot to do with the snake and the wolf and predatory animals and whatnot. But I was thinking that if she exists and she's always there and she's the source of creativity, resilience, joy and whatnot, and she's unchanged by what's going on, then it doesn't matter if we're in lockdown because she's free and she'll always be free. And then it doesn't matter if this person did this thing to me because she's free and she'll always be free. Mm-hmm. And so basically this whole new body of work, which I'm calling Nomi, which is going to be a solo show in London. Slash online. is an exploration of all of these themes. And I think is the first time that I've actually enjoyed making my work, which was actually your question, which I'm now finally circling back to.
Well, I'd imagine that with the work that you've done previously, there's elements that would be triggering for other women in their honest focus on violence. Would you have women coming up and sharing experiences with trauma? You know, is, I'm sure, amazing as it is potentially a cathartic experience for them, I'm sure that also could be quite heavy and kind of keep you in a loop of that kind of energy.
Yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot. And it's not something that they teach you in art school. Right. And it's not something your gallery is going to pull you aside and chat to you about.
Be like, you're a therapist now also.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. You have to figure it out. And I don't know how to answer and respond often other than, you know, just to like listen and hold space. Yeah. And but yeah, it happens a lot, particularly if I give a class or a talk publicly, then I will often during a Q&A and afterwards, I will have women coming and sharing their experiences, which is so, so beautiful to know that that they feel that they can and that they want to and that the work moves them in that way. But I also, I don't consider myself equipped for that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, so I've had to do some work on like how to just be okay in those instances.
Yeah. And also I'm sure let your voice develop and explore other ways of seeing and experiencing so that you don't have to be constantly in touch with trauma as a muse.
Right. Exactly. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's such a beautiful way of putting it. Trauma as a muse. Yeah.
Yeah. I've always been so curious about your way of sharing your viewpoint on the female experience. And now I'm going to give you my history, which is like,
please do. Inevitable. I welcome it.
Because I feel like I've had almost a much more masculine experience. I have been really close with my dad since I was little and dealt with some trust issues with my mom at a young age and was bullied really badly in school by girls and dealt with issues even in the workplace early on with older women. And I've realized over time that I've built up a bit of distrust with women, especially like women in groups. And it's interesting as an adult to dig up those formative experiences and just look at them from as neutral of a place as possible and ask yourself, like, is this way of thinking working for me? Is this narrative holding me back? Like, how do I deal with this? And so I've been very lucky not to experience, I think, as many of the traumatic experiences with men. They've mostly been with women. And so it's just interesting how different all of those experiences are.
Yeah, I think it's really important to talk about. I'm so with you on that. And it's something, I remember being asked to be on a panel. It was, you know, when like feminism was the cool thing and everyone wanted to talk about feminism, right?
Totally.
And they were like, we want this conversation to really be about like women who have lifted you up.
Yeah.
And I was like, so great. Can't wait. Can we also talk about this like very real phenomenon that women tear the fuck out of each other?
Yes.
And like, because this is also very important. Absolutely. Because it's a product of patriarchy. And they were like, no, we really just want it to be a positive panel. And I was like, but it's not a positive experience.
Yeah.
It's not like, it's so complex.
And so you faced a bit of that as well.
Oh my God, so much. And in my career, the moments and instances that have like brought me to tears and made me feel so shit about myself and really question like, am I even talented? Am I just an idiot? Like that's been due to women and older women often who just want to put me the fuck in my place and have gone about that in a way that's really unkind and is part of that kind of like tribal bullying, I don't know, like way of being. And I think that it's a product of patriarchy, which doesn't excuse it in any way. We all have to, I think as women, we all have that in us. Like I have an inner bitch, you know, and sometimes she's an outer bitch.
Yeah, totally.
Oh my God. Totally. Yeah. You know, and like I recognize within myself, sometimes I feel really threatened and I want to just like put someone down, like not to their face because I'm too much of a scaredy cat, but like if I feel threatened by another woman, which is usually for me like a sexual thing, you know, in a relationship, when you encounter someone who's like just complete smoke show and brilliant and funny and whatnot, and you kind of want to go, she's so full of herself, or like find something bitchy to say, innit? Like that is such a real thing. You want to do that, and you want your boyfriend to be like,
yeah, those teeth aren't real.
Yeah, exactly. She's so, I mean, you can't tell because you're a man, but she had all the Botox, I'm telling you. But so I have that within myself, and I have to like recognize it and get on top of it, because, and look at where it comes from. Like I now am aware that this thing exists because we have been fed by men this, and by, you know, just patriarchy that is age old, this belief that we're in competition with each other. Why? Because there's a finite amount of power and resources available to us, and we need those for our survival. And so I think that basically we can trace it back to the birth of agriculture. I'm sorry, this is very, I'm going on a proper tangent.
No, totally. Do it. I read Sapiens. Let's do it.
Yeah. It's my understanding that, you know, we used to just live off the land and forage off the land, and the land was free and for whatever group were inhabiting it at the time.
Yeah.
And the child rearing and birthing was more of a kind of like village responsibility
community
thing.
Yeah.
Exactly. Less emphasis on pair bonds.
Right.
And then once we started to farm the land, that then led to like splitting up the land.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when men came in and were like, well, this is my plot over here, this is your plot over there and whatnot.
Yeah.
And because the men did that, that meant that the women had to pair bond with the men for their own survival. Otherwise, they're going to go hungry, they're going to die, and their children are going to die. Who's going to look after them?
Right.
We need the men who are suddenly sectioning out the land to look after us.
And this is like Sex at Dawn. Did you read
Sex at Dawn?
Yeah,
exactly,
totally. So it's like,
exactly.
Yeah, the birth of monogamy as
exactly,
like a
the birth
Christian,
of monogamy.
Yep.
Completely.
Totally.
But also the birth of female competition and jealousy.
Right.
Because, you know, if I have to try and secure my survival, I'm going to have to like make myself look good or try and prove that I'm very fertile and whatnot. And therefore that then led to, well, I have to make her look bad and put her down, you know? And so, and that still exists today, in that we feel we're socialized to believe that like there isn't enough shine for all the women to have it, you know? And that if one person's shiny, they're taking away from your shining.
Yeah.
And it's not really our fault, because...
Well, and it's also just been put on like turbo drive with social media, because...
Oh my God, yes.
You know, there's that compare and despair thing where it used to be like, okay, there's two other people of my age demographic in my village, and that one has like one eye and that one has a broken leg, so I'm the most attractive. Whereas now we're like comparing ourselves to the entire world, and it's such an insanely narcissistic generation, and I completely include myself in that. But I think it is so interesting that even though it feels like we've come a long way with feminism in certain ways, there's still this emphasis on the exterior that feels kind of archaic at this point. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that it's so rampant.
Yeah. And it's not equitable. Like it's not like men on social media are pressured into objectifying themselves as much or in the same way as women. And that's, I'm not saying that there aren't like guys with their top off and that's their whole feed. Of course that exists.
Well, if anything, that's usually the one where I'm like, well, I don't think I can date him with a straight face.
Exactly.
Like I want someone with a terrible Instagram. If I'm dating them, I want them to be taking like blurry photos of like nature, or like you can only be,
and they barely post.
Exactly. Or you can only be good if you're a photographer. That's your job.
Yeah.
I know, it's wild.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee, start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
So you've dealt with some issues with women in the art world. What are some of the roadblocks you've faced based on gender, and how have you navigated those?
Being taken seriously as a female artist has been the hardest thing. I think that when I started to show my work after school, after becoming a mom, and then really like delving into like a more I think evolved art practice, and then I started to show that work, I was introduced to the art world as this young British artist who's married to this TV star. And so the art world was very ready to be like, psh, nah. And it was really hard work. I had to make sure that what I was putting out there, that my work was fucking good and deep and well-made and interesting, and to keep doing, and like the next show to top the last show, you know, and the next series to continue to build upon that and chip away at the people, the gatekeepers in the art world who really didn't want to take me seriously as an artist.
And who are keeping an eye out for privilege or...
Exactly.
But it must be really interesting to have shown up with the history that you have. It's not like you showed up with like, here's my trust fund and my whatever, and I'm you know, making this little thing on the side because I've never had a job. Like, you had been a cocktail waitress for 5 years. You'd had all of this very real, dark, deep experience. And then based on who you fell in love with, that taints things potentially for some time.
Absolutely. And it's been hard to, I guess, like, close myself off from those critical voices and go like, people, like, haters are going to hate and people are going to judge. They don't know that I went out when I was 12 years old and got my first job. Do you know what I mean? They don't know that I lied about my age and was sweeping up hair in a hair salon from 12 just because I needed and wanted more pocket money. Like, if they're going to see me as a gold digger, that's really on them, because my marriage, though it's over, it was beautiful and earnest, and we made an incredible kid together, and we're great friends now.
That's so great.
And it was pure, and it just didn't work out.
But it did, right? Like,
it did. Thank you. That's such a good point. It did work out. It did. Yes, you're right.
We have this idea that things ending means they're a failure, but life ends and life's not a failure. Yes. So I think that it's important to reframe things that way. I mean, it sounds like
thank you
have an incredible co-parent and an incredible kid and amazing memories. And that's a success.
Yes. Agreed.
Yeah. Did all of those issues that you faced when you entered the art world make it difficult for you to feel comfortable calling yourself an artist for a while?
Yep, definitely. I didn't start calling myself an artist until after I became a mum.
Really?
Yeah.
Were those things tied?
Yeah, I think so, because I think when I gave birth, it was the first time in my life that I'd actually been like fully in control of anything and commanded a space and known what to do and felt like I knew what to do. It was just, it was very intuitive for me. I gave birth at home with no pain meds, and, you know, I was super, super lucky and fortunate that it went smoothly. But for me, it was really formative because, you know, I was this girl in this house full of men, and I went to state schools in London where you only got paid attention to if you were like throwing chairs and whatnot. Yeah. There was always some rowdy boy throwing a chair.
Yeah.
So I kind of like disappeared, and then, you know, and then was the girlfriend of this like known guy, then the wife of this known guy. And so I've never really taken up space before. And then suddenly I'm in labor and bless him, he's freaking out, but I know what to do. For some reason, it was as if I'd done it before. And so that experience on an interpersonal level was so huge for me. And once, you know, I started to process the birth and the fact that I'm now a mum and I'm holding this baby and I've got so much to do that all involves sustaining her life and whatnot, I just realized that, oh, wow, like I create. I'm not a photographer. I'm not a fine art photographer. I just create. And so I guess then I'm an artist. And so it felt really weird having the words come out of my mouth the first few times. Like I literally remember being at a dinner or something and someone going, oh, so what do you do? And I was like, oh, I'm an artist. And I thought someone's going to jump up and go, no, you're not.
Just all of your inner critics are going to do that.
Exactly. So I was like looking over my shoulder and like, shit, they didn't really let me get away with that.
I might try it again sometime.
Exactly.
Your first show was a celebration of becoming a mother, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Present Life, it was called. Yeah.
Can you tell me a bit about the role that text plays in your work? Because obviously that stemmed from the first photography stuff, which is now
demolished. So even it's funny because my dad pointed out to me recently, he was like, we've not forgotten what you were making doing photography A-level, but I was drawing and writing on my friends' bodies and photographing them. Anyway, I don't actually want to talk about that work because it was like, if I thought Lose was shit, that work was shit. But I have always been really into text and into literature and poetry and rap lyrics and the things that people say and the things that people say to me as well. So for my first show, Present Life, I'd created the work, which was very much about time and trying to use art to freeze the moment when something living starts to die. And so my placenta, which was plastinated, was in the show in marble, and I was working with neon for the first time and all of these things. And I had a meeting with the gallery. They had this ground floor, beautiful space on the Bowery, and then they had this basement space. And they were like, do you want to present the work over both floors? And me as like, you know, woman, first solo show in New York, I was like, oh, no, couldn't possibly, give the basement to like another artist that you think would be in good conversation with my work.
Right.
And then I went home from that meeting and I was like, dude, you idiot. This might be your last chance to show work in New York.
You're like, give the placenta her own floor.
Exactly. Give the placenta her own floor. Precisely. I was like, think like a man. Like, no man, when offered two levels, more space, would turn that down. Like, come on, Buckman. So I said, all right, if I'm going to present work underground as well as on the ground floor, then that has to make sense to me. Like, it shouldn't just be the same kind of work but downstairs.
There's like a contextual separation.
Exactly. Like, if you're coming down the stairs, I want for you to go down deeper into the subconscious.
Yeah.
And so when I was pregnant, I had these crazy dreams, which is super common, and I had written some of them down. And so I went back and I found the transcribe of this one dream in which I had dreamt that I'd given birth, except the baby was actually this gooey little blackbird. Because, you know, you think a lot about like, well, what if the baby's born with a defect, or what if this, or what if that, you know, can I, would I love it?
Yeah.
And I gave birth to this gooey, scrawny little blackbird with these blinking, beautiful black eyes and this beak. And I instantly fell in love, and I knew that that was my baby. But my heart broke at the same time, because I knew that I'd never hear her talk, that she'd never utter a word to me, right? And as you know, language and words are very important to me. And so anyway, basically, I decided that I would embroider little bits from this dream onto my grandmother's lace table runner. And so I painted all the walls this kind of maroon, and I put sand on the floor, and you came down, descended into that lower level of the gallery, and it was like this dark, like almost womb-like space with this wooden table, and people would read the text on the lace runner. And I had women crying and referring to it as the poem. They were like, I really loved your poem piece, which was interesting, because I never considered myself a writer then, and certainly not one that like created poetry. But that was how some women had felt. And I realized that that down there, that installation was the most successful part of that first show. And then I've continued to use text since then.
Yeah. Did people freak about the placenta?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Someone tried to buy it. It's funny because, I mean, it's like, it's not really that funny because it's disappointing, but it was the only piece in the whole show that was not for sale. And I was desperate to make a sale. My first show, I was like, I need a check.
Yeah.
Like, someone needs to write me a check for all this hard work. Come on. I don't want this work coming back to my studio. I want it gone. Apart from the placenta.
Right.
I can't in good faith sell that because it's Cleo's, really. It's my daughter's, you know.
It's her first house. Like,
exactly. It's her first house. And I ain't making another one.
No. Totally.
Certainly not for the purpose of art. And so, like, on the first day, this really like big deal, amazing art collector came in and was like, how much for the placenta? And I was like, that's not for sale. I'm so sorry, but would Madam perhaps like any of these other words? Like, it was like, she was like, no, really, how much? I was like, no, I'm not trying to like.
Oh, you're so good. I would have sold it. I would have sold it.
What do they call it? Like screwballing something? No, what do they call it? Highballing someone?
Yeah. No, exactly. You're not like.
When you try
Yeah, that thing that you do. It's not a move.
Yeah, that thing. Yeah, this isn't a play to get more money out of yours. Like, literally, like, no, I'm sorry, it's not for sale. And then she didn't buy anything from that show, bless her.
No.
But she did later. She got some work later from a different series. But
I'm clearly so not a mom yet. I'm like, oh, just sell it. It's fine. You don't need it.
Sometimes I wonder if I should have, but there it is. Like, I'm looking at it right now, and I guess it'll stick around for now.
I love that a Keats poem inspired the title of your Let Her Rave series. Do you know it by heart? You have such a beautiful voice. This is just a sneaky way of hearing you read poetry.
Bless you. I do. Let's see. So he goes, so he's talking about joy and melancholy, things that I think about a lot, obviously, as someone who experiences depression.
Yeah.
And I loved this poem from when I was 18. But so basically, when I first studied Keats at school, and I remember my mum helping me work on his poetry and fully understand it, I thought it was so romantic, this line. He says, so when the melancholy fit shall fall, sudden from heaven like a weeping cloud that fosters the droop-headed flowers all and hides the green hill in an April shroud. So that's all about like depression and rain and blah, blah, blah. Then glut thy sorrow on a morning rose, or on the rainbow of the salt sand wave, or on the wealth of globed peonies. And I'm like, oh, so pretty, so lovely. Yeah, glut your sorrow on all this, on nature and beautiful transcendent. Yeah. And then he goes, or if thy mistress some rich anger shows, imprison her soft hand and let her rave and feed deep, deep upon her peerless eyes. And at the time, 18 years old, hadn't fallen in love yet, hadn't had my heart broken yet. I was like, oh, that's so nice.
Yeah. Aww, he's letting her have her emotional moment, holding her hand.
Boo-boo. Yeah, he's like, I'm going to just imprison your soft hand and I will allow you to rave. Oh, no, I that's what I want in a man.
Oh, my God.
And then...
Careful what you wish for.
Older, exactly. Very much so. Very much so. As I got older, I was like, I still love you, Keith. I still love what you did. And I think you were a genius. And I'm very sorry that you died so young. But I also have a problem.
I have some notes.
This could do with an update, my friend. You know, this idea of, like, first of all, her soft hand and in prison, like, just even just using the word in prison when you're referring to someone that you love is, like, so terribly problematic and telling.
Yeah.
And then even just let her rave, like,
allow her.
The bitch will rave.
Her hysterical moment.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes, I'm going to give you this little box in which you can rave.
Totally. Make it quick.
Make it quick, darling. Would you try not to break anything? And aren't I a feminist and such a good evolved man? So I personally am really interested in my work in exploring things that aren't super black and white. Like it's not a misogynistic poem. I'm not interested in going like, this thing over here is really bad and this is wrong. I'm more like, oh, wow, that's fucking interesting. Yeah. I have a problem with that. I also love some of it. Yeah. I've also fallen into that trap myself.
Yeah.
And that's what I wanted to explore with that series, Let Her Rave.
So much more nuance. And it's amazing that there is that line about the soft hands and you were using boxing gloves.
Boxing gloves. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did that come about because of your boxing practice?
Mm, yeah. So I was going into the boxing gym about 4 or 5 times a week. At the time that I was like probably most obsessed with boxing and training and starting to spar and whatnot, I was in the process of separating out of my marriage. And so there was a lot, I had a lot of like frustration and disillusionment. And I was going down into this space, which as we spoke about earlier, was like super testosterone heavy and reminded me of home and my brothers and Hackney streets and school and all the things. And the experience of sparring and like having someone punch me or having a fist fly at my face, I was like, shit, like it put me back in touch with that instinctual force that I think I had lost touch with a little bit, you know.
Mm, yeah.
Know me, that protector, that creator. So it became quite an attractive time for me, the time at the boxing gym. And then of course I would come home and goes into my studio, like with my boxing gloves slung around my shoulder. And so I think that, like, even just visually, what I was seeing was starting to impact what I wanted to be making in the studio.
Yeah.
And then I was thinking a lot about marriage and patriarchal constructs that I think put us in on a pedestal or in a box. I was thinking about chastity and purity, which, of course, like, even those words, like, makes me think of the Romantic poets and Keats.
Yeah.
And so remembered that very poem, which just felt so fitting with what I wanted to explore in my work at the time. So then I started to collect used wedding dresses, and then I just like bulk bought a bunch of boxing gloves and started to create these sculptural works with these wedding dresses, which I would like wrap around the boxing gloves and create these hanging sculptures.
It's so cool that you use vintage for that too, because all those dresses have their own story, right? So
Absolutely.
You're incorporating all of those into the narrative of your work.
Yeah, that's been super important to me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just this idea that they've had a life. I don't know what that is.
Yeah.
You know, they've seen, like, if it's a tea towel, if it's lingerie or a wedding dress, like, they've seen some things. And now here they are in my studio and I'm like working with the history that these materials already come to me with.
Yeah. Okay, tell me about Champ.
Yes.
9-foot uterus.
Yes.
With boxing gloves as ovaries that was rotating on a 3-story pole outside the Standard Hotel on the Sunset Strip in LA. I remember like driving and being like, oh my God, Zoe.
Oh, you saw it.
I saw it. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was incredible. It was incredible.
Thank you. Thank you. So similar time, it was 2015, and it was the run up to the election here. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, the election. Right. And it was the one where like I mean, I've lived through, I guess, 4 elections here in the States, mm-hmm. and I've noticed that it always happens during campaigning. Like, suddenly it's like rape is an open topic again, yeah. and abortion and all these
reproductive rights are suddenly
It's suddenly back on the table for debate by like old white guys.
I'm like, I thought we figured this out.
Really, guys? Like, seriously, yeah. we're back here, yeah. So there was a lot being circulated and said about rape and abortion and all of this stuff. And again, yeah, going to the boxing gym and feeling like there was just a lot of fighting, like. There's a war on women on the outside. There's kind of like a war in my home on the inside. Yeah. And I got back from boxing and went into the studio and I actually meditated. And then I just kind of pictured this glowing uterus where the ovaries are. There were boxing gloves. And, you know, I've had like obstetric experiences and surgeries and you know I have had an abortion and I've had other things that have had to be taken care of, and so I feel like that sense of like when they talk about things in the press about our rights to choice or our autonomy over our body, like I do take that shit personally. Yeah. Like, you're talking about me. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And like you curtail women's rights to like screenings and shit, that's fucked. Like, and I have something to say about that.
Yeah.
So yeah, I pictured this piece and then I made it and I put it on my studio wall. The size was determined, the original sculpture that I made on my studio wall out of neon, the size of it was determined by the fact that I was using my boxing gloves as the ovary.
Right.
And so then those were a defined size, and so that it didn't look ridiculous, I kind of like sketched out a uterus shape per that.
Yeah.
And then people started to see that and it circulated. And then, of course, Trump was elected, which was a big surprise to me and most of us here on the left side of things. And so then the piece kind of had even more, was just disseminated even more.
Yeah.
To the point that Art Production Fund, which is a public art organization here, asked me if I wanted to make a public sculpture version mm-hmm. and for that to live outside the Stand Hotel Hollywood.
Yeah.
To which I was like, yes, I do. Yes. I would like that very much.
You're like, I'm going to need some very large boxing gloves.
Yeah, exactly.
I love that you've given yourself so much space to play with medium and repurpose materials in different contexts to show juxtapositions between softness and strength, whether it's like embroidering a rap lyric or a boxing glove that's made of a wedding dress, and the context in which, even just what you were saying about placing the subconscious on a separate floor within a show, that seems like such a fun way to play with not just subject matter, but medium.
Thank you. Thank you for picking up on that, because it is really important to me. These sort of polarized ideas and states and the hard and the soft and the masculine and the feminine and finding where they intersect is something that I'm really drawn to.
Yeah. There also seems to be a really purposeful choice in your work to display often quite ugly or difficult experiences with so much beauty in the aesthetic quality of the pieces themselves. How would you describe your use of beauty as a vehicle for message?
Yeah, I think that as artists, we are kind of, beauty is our medium in many ways, you know, and we're kind of in the business of aesthetics in some way. Even if you're like using what is grotesque, right? Mm-hmm. You're still like, that's still an aesthetic choice to deliver a message.
Yeah.
And so I use beauty in my work as a way of like drawing people in mm-hmm. and like inviting people to come close. I'm not personally into making work that kind of like shouts a point. I want you to come in and like, and maybe something looks like very delicate, very feminine, and like the colors are pastels or whatever it is, that deliberate choice. And then you're drawn in like, that's yummy. You know, we are all a little bit like moths in some ways. Like, oh, that looks kind of appealing. And then in that space, you're allowed to take something in more than if it was like screaming at you, you know? I also think that I'm just more, I'm more interested in work that does a variety of things at the same time.
Yeah.
So to be honest with you, when I was collecting all of this vintage lingerie and I wanted to put Biggie and Tupac lyrics that refer to women onto the lingerie and create this installation. Mm-hmm. I imagine the whole thing, like you'd be walking in this space and they'd be hanging from the ceiling on invisible thread. And so the slips and the bras and what have you, they would like dance and move. And I was like, how am I going to get the text on there? And I thought, Sharpie it, cut it out so that like light comes through mm-hmm. the text. And that all just felt too violent. I'm like, yeah. I'm not trying to call these men violent. I'm not trying to label hip hop as a genre as contributing to the violent nature of our culture.
Or Keats.
Exactly. Or yeah. Keats. Exactly. Yeah. I'm trying to have a nuanced conversation. Yeah. And so it was important to me then, and I guess always has been, that I'm using beauty to talk about something that is ugly, mm-hmm. such as violence or having one's power taken away, right?
Yeah.
But if it's inevitable, which unfortunately it is, it can't be all ugly, right? If it's inevitable and so many of us go through it, and then so many of us survive it, and so survival isn't ugly, survival has to be something that is celebrated. And so mm-hmm. this is all a very long-winded way of saying, I think that like if I'm making work about rape or grief, like these things that are so dark and difficult, I want to use beauty because I want to show that there is a way through, there is an other side of it, you know, and we can also all like help each other.
Yeah.
And that's a big part of the work as well, is about like women coming together and helping each other out of these experiences.
Where does sexuality fit within this conversation when trauma and sexual violence is such a strong part of your work and personal story? What still works about that tension between the masculine and the feminine and the exploration of power and force and freedom without fear attached to it?
Yeah. I think that I'm still on a journey with that personally in figuring out like how to communicate what I want and my desires, because they're fucking complex. Like
yeah.
sometimes I want to be held and yeah. I want someone to look into my eyes, and other times I do not want to be held.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Sometimes you want to be held down.
Sometimes I want to be held down. Sometimes I want to be called some really awful things. Yeah. I would never want you to call me that the next day when we're having breakfast.
And they're like, don't put it in your art tomorrow.
Right, exactly. Am I going to be a tea towel? You might.
Exactly. You might.
So I think particularly in my series Heavy Rag, which was my last show, there was some text in there. There were some things that had been said to me that were like definitely not okay, and some mm-hmm. things that had been said to other women that were definitely not okay. But I was also exploring power and power within sexual relationships as well, that yeah. like that came out of me exploring domination and submission. And so I don't look at that stuff as bad. I mean, it's really complex, and it takes people to be really open to
yeah.
to embrace work that is looking at violence, but is also looking at like sexual play.
Desire.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's a whole other level of nuance, especially if people put you on that mantle of being like the woman who is properly talking about sexual violence.
Right.
How dare you explore right. sexuality
exactly
within that?
Exactly. Absolutely. Yeah.
Do you feel pressure around that?
Sometimes I do. Yeah, honestly, I do. And then I have to, again, remind myself that is, because the pressure is mainly from other women, right?
Yeah, no, totally.
Like, wait a second, Zoe, don't publicly say anything about how you like people to pull your hair.
Yeah, guys are fine with you saying that.
Right, exactly. Exactly. Guys are fine with me saying it. Other women are like, hang on a second. No. You're a feminist.
Yeah.
You're an intersexual.
Yeah, give us another placenta.
Yeah, give us another placenta. Don't talk about how you want to be called those mean names in certain contexts. But I also then have to remind myself that in itself, like what we were talking about before, is a product of sexism and patriarchy, because it's this idea that we have to be one thing or the other thing. We have to be the Madonna or the whore.
Yeah.
You know, and that there's no gray area, and we can't be both, and we can't be both at once.
Yeah.
And the reason that we feel that, and we feel that about others, is because of our own ingrained competition with each other, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. How do you hope that your work will make women feel, and how do you hope that it'll make men feel?
That's such a good question. These are all such good questions. truly, you really know your stuff.
Oh, it's so nice to chat.
I want women to feel seen by my work. That's really important to me. I remember my brother coming to my last solo show, Heavy Rag, and the piece that was at the door of the gallery, it said, inaction is apathy, is collusion, is violence. And so it's the first thing that you saw when you walked in, but then you took in the whole show, and then it would be also the last thing that you saw. And I don't remember making that choice deliberately, to be honest with you, but he was like, yo, that's really, he goes, this is hard. This is hard as a man. Like, it's good hard, because it's like, I come in here and I'm like, yeah, in action. Mm-hmm, yes, my sister's work. And like, then I see it all and I read it all, and I walk up the stairs and I take it all in, and I come downstairs, and then I'm like reminded, like, inaction is apathy, is collusion, is violence. And it's like, I'm responsible and I have to make some changes. And it hadn't been an intention of mine. And I don't tend to think about how the work will affect men, but I was so moved that he had had that response to it. And every time I get men sharing their responses to the work, I'm like, nine times out of ten, so touched that they have felt that way,
and that you created in a way that wasn't shouty and it wasn't calling anybody out, and it allowed for that conversation to take place. Because if you feel attacked, you're not receptive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they have so much work to do, men, and they are also victims of patriarchy and survivors of patriarchy. Yeah. Like, I'm glad I'm not a man. Do you know what I mean? That I don't want to be dealing with that. No.
I'm happy.
No, not here for it. Me too.
Well, tell me a bit about the London show that's coming up, and what you're excited about and hopeful for.
Yeah. So the London show, it's the first time that I've ever had a show be entirely online, which is just, to be honest with you, it's gutting.
Yeah. And it's your first show in your hometown.
It's my first, exactly. It's my first show in London. The work's not going to London. I'm not going to London. It's going to exist essentially on a website, on the gallery's website. And so she's an amazing gallerist that I've really wanted to work with for years. And it's, her name is Pippi Howlsworth, Pippi Howlsworth Gallery. So it will go up on her website February the 11th. But I guess what I am reminding myself and what I'm excited about with this new format is that it will allow me to share the work in a wider way. Like, you know, and just if the online view is as like tight as it can be, which I'm hopeful that it will be. I mean, in terms of like, there's really good images and you can really get a sense of the work and there's good writing about it, I will be able to share that with people, you know, all over the place. Yeah. And so that's exciting.
You just miss like the drinks with your friends afterwards.
I wanted the drinks. I wanted to stand in the space with my girlfriend. And also, this is the first time that I've actually depicted forms in my work. So there's animals, there's snakes and wolves and eagles, but there's also, I've been collaging and embroidering pictures of my best friends. you know, them out dancing, living their best life. And so I was so excited for them to come and pick themselves out in the work.
Yeah, like grab a canapé and go find yourself.
Exactly.
Well, that's really exciting. I can't wait to see it.
Yeah. Oh, I can't wait to share it with you. And then hopefully the plan with the gallery is that I will have a show next year in real life. But again, we'll see. I mean, who even knows what's going to happen with COVID and London and all the things. I'm just trying to look at this online show as its own standalone thing and embrace that and in a way just kind of kiss it up to bud, yeah. You know, and what will come of it will come of it.
Yeah, well, it's nice that we at least have technology in this moment to keep us all connected, right?
Yes, so true.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to do this.
I'm so appreciative. It's so nice to see you.
It's so nice to see you too. And usually we're like really sweaty.
Really sweaty.
And that, beautiful people, concludes this episode of The Inspirati. I hope you picked up some inspiration to take into your day. Please rate, review, subscribe, and leave a comment if you're enjoying these conversations. You can follow The Inspirati on Instagram or find me at alex.merrill. Stay inspired and keep creating. The world needs it more than ever.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Ando.
And I'm Fer.
And we host Niñas Bien podcast.
We want to invite you to listen to our show.
Niñas Bien means good girls in Spanish. But you have to know that this is not a podcast for good girls.
Or for girls at all. It is a comedy podcast. So everyone is welcome to listen.
We talk about sex, relationships, technology.
We recommend movies and TV shows and discuss pop culture in general.
And there is Chisme Ajeno too.
A section we have just to gossip about everyone. So you'll find something you like here.
And you'll practice your Spanish.
The cleanest Spanish you'll find, we promise.
And if you already hablas español,
vamos a ser tus nuevas amigas. We'll be your friends for the non-Spanish speakers.
New episodes every Monday and Thursday.
Hosted by Acast and available to all audio platforms.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.